All right, we have discussed the first, I will abbreviate it, philosophical impasse, which was about what time in history? About what time in history was the first philosophical impasse?
I've got a question.
Now, wait a minute, I want an answer before I'll take a question.
Anybody else just really distracted by the horns? I just keep looking at
horns here. Yeah.
Students do in your classroom, Dykstra.
I don't have anything.
But explain. Pheasants. We, animals crawling around. You're a good one to bring that.
I remember.
About 460 to 430 BC.
Thank you. Excellent. Was that what you were going to say, Ms. Culberson?
Wasn't it the golden age?
It was the golden age.
Thank you. That's what
it was, the golden age. Oddly enough, the so-called golden age of Greek history was the time when Greek philosophy was in a period of malaise. Okay? So, but it's the time when the Parthenon was being built and Pericles was ruling and Greek democracy was at its height. So we're in that sandwich period. I'll abbreviate this philosophical impasse equals golden age. You can write that down. Before this period, we had the conflict between Ionia and where?
Greece. Wait, no.
The conflict between Ionia and
Italia.
The Italians, the ancient Republicans, the Ionians, the ancient Democrats, it all comes back to you, doesn't it? Kind of flowing back into your brain like molasses. Parmenides and Heraclitus, the conflict unresolved during this era. And then we have we've talked about two philosophical movements that more or less dominate the stage during this era. And they would be, who are they? This is during the Golden Age, basically two kind of currents in philosophy that are more or less on, you know, in the air during this time, and they are, what's it called? That's more the great conflict here between them. Go ahead. Thank you. See, that's very good. I noticed that the elementary teachers are coming through with lots of good answers. Not hearing much from the secondary staff. So. All right, that's correct. The Cynics and the Sophists. Neither of which was offering any answers to the big questions. This is more the small questions. How to be happy, how to make money, how to win friends and influence people, how to get along in life, right? That's what's going on. And of course, a pure democracy, that's the kind of skill you want. You want to be able to massage public opinion to your own benefit. Who's the most famous Cynic? His name is?
Diogenes.
Excellent. The most famous Sophist?
Protagoras,
man the measure. Very good. Okay. Then we came down. Of course, we have the conflict between Plato and Aristotle, and we've talked about that. And that brings us then to another period, which is a philosophical, there's a philosophical impasse, which brings us another era of a kind of malaise. Another time when people are despairing of the big questions and big answers, and more or less winding up once again dealing with kind of how to be happy. And again, in this period, we have two dominant philosophies. They share a lot in common in the sense that they are both trying to answer the same questions, but they're giving somewhat different answers. Neither of them is trying to answer the big questions that divided Plato from Aristotle. They're answering more of the questions that we found up here with the Sophists and the Cynics. Okay, so but different schools, different answers. And you know the answers here because I've got them. This is the one thing you actually have in your notes. So you should be able to see that. So we have the Epicureans and the Stoics. And then we will tuck in, as time permits, a little discussion of Philo. who is, I think, also fits in this period and comes a little bit later. So, if I ask you, Mr. Dupree, what comes to your mind when I say to you the word Epicurean? What does that conjure up in your imagination?
Food.
Food. Absolutely. What else is that? I mean, food certainly comes to mind. Anything else?
Wine.
Ah, that's good. Okay, yes.
Williams
Mona. That's right.
That's all there. That's different eras.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Very good. Yeah.
Parties.
Eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow.
Eat, there you go. Eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die. All right. Interestingly, Epicurus himself would be embarrassed to hear all of these answers, you know, because he himself lived a life that looks more like a medieval ascetic than like the kind of image that we have of Epicurus and Epicureanism. But it's still a legitimate answer, and certainly we've come to think in those terms. So Epicurus, his dates are 340 to 270. So what's happened here? Well, we have the end of the Peloponnesian Wars in round numbers around the year 400. We have Plato in the early 300s. We have Aristotle in the later 300s. The birth, then, of Epicurus is when Aristotle is about 20 years out from his death. So he's born, you know, about 20 years before the death of Aristotle. And so then he lives well into that next century and, as I say, kind of introduces then this what we call the Hellenistic period. He is an atomic materialist. You just put a little heading on him. Atomic materialist. So, Ms. Allard, if I called you an atomic materialist, would you consider that a compliment?
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay, that's good. It's very good. What does that mean? Anybody? What does it mean to be an atomic materialist?
Stuff's made of small things.
Yeah, everything's made of small things, right? And the materialist part means?
It's all matter.
Okay, yeah, that's all there is. A materialist, remember that goes clear back to the Ionians, a materialist, that's all there is, and the substance by which all matter is made up is atoms. Now, there was an earlier philosopher who taught that, so at this point, Epicurus is following an earlier thinker who was kind of the original atomic materialist, and his name was? Just Democritus. Just helps get name recognition, you know, just kind of get used to hearing these names and those connections. So Epicurus follows Democritus. And Democritus, in some ways, shares something of the same philosophy, but Epicurus took it to a much higher level of sophistication. In 306, Epicurus moved to Athens and founded a school, and the name of the school was the...
Oh.
I know, it's tempting, isn't it? No, that was Aristotle.
The Epicurean school.
No. The garden. Isn't that lovely? I like that. The garden. Probably the main influences that led to Epicurus and his thought, this is arbitrary, but I'd say there's three. There is Democritus that we've already mentioned. There is Aristippus, A-R-I-S-T-I-P-U-S. Did we talk about him last time? Okay, Aristippus. Aristippus was part of a school called the Cyrenaics, C-Y-R-E. N-A-I-C-S, the Cyrenaics. And Aristippus is probably the first great consistent hedonist in history. So Aristippus, who by the way lives about the same time as Socrates, lives in that earlier era. And the Cyrenaics were the original really robust, you might say crass, hedonists. which is what many people think of when you think of Epicurean, don't you? You think of hedonism, but they're not the same thing. So this is the guy who, I realize it's a little before dinner, I'll try not to turn your stomachs too much, but Aristippus was the guy who encouraged his followers to eat, gorge themselves, just as the most delicious food and eat as much of it as you can, and then when you've eaten so much that you're at the point of being ill, what do? You throw up. And then you go back and eat some more, you see. And so it's just the most raw, crass kind of hedonistic indulgence that you can imagine. So that was Aristippus. And so he was an influence. So you got Democritus, Aristippus. And the other was Aristotle. And especially that little part of Aristotle that we looked at right at the end last time, which was Aristotle's idea of happiness, you know, and the different levels of happiness. Remember that? So those three influences. The person probably that Epicurus was most taken with was Aristippus. But he noticed that strange aspect of the hedonism that he experienced that created what's called and what has been called the hedonistic paradox. And I think we did touch on that last time, didn't we? Didn't that ring a bell? So the hedonistic paradox, Mr. Palvin, in simple terms, one or two sentences.
Wasn't here.
Bags out, but I bet you could actually figure it out. What happens? Anybody? Go ahead. What? Ms. Allard? Hedonistic paradox? Anybody? What is it?
I think it was that as you continue to go after the most desirable thing, it becomes no longer desirable.
Okay. That's right. Okay.
Oh, you got it.
He got it. All of it. It's the whole deal. I think, you know, chocolate chip cookies was our example. I think it would apply as well to Butterfinger candy bars. You know, as much as I like them, I relish them, I live for them, I just, you know, love to eat them. But I know that as much as I like them, if I eat one or two, it's fine. If I eat 30 or 40, it's not so good. That I begin experiencing pain. And that's the paradoxical character of hedonism. That if I really throw myself in to the pursuit with no restraint of pleasure, I will finally wind up in a great deal of pain. And I have to ask myself the question, was it worth it? You know, I remember when I was in college, as a college freshman, at Whitworth, of all things. Of course, it's a very different place now, you understand. But at the time, I had these guys. I think, in my opinion, the perfect example of the crass hedonist in our culture is the male college freshman. You know, they're off to school, they're free, they don't have any of the constraints anymore, and they just dive in with a kind of reckless abandon to the pursuit of pleasure. And how I remember so well the lovely sounds of waking up in the middle of the night about 2 a.m. to that horrible sound in the men's room, you know, it's just kind of warms your heart, doesn't it, to think how much pleasure people have gotten from their experience. And that really is pretty much the Cyrenaic philosophy. And Epicurus figured out, this something about this doesn't add up, you know, there's just not much in it that is too appealing. So he agreed, and this is the core thing, he agreed that the highest good, the thing we should pursue, is pleasure. He's an atomic materialist. There's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no ultimate accountability. Pleasure, therefore, must be the main thing. You pursue pleasure, you avoid pain, but Epicurus figured out that you have to do that in a very, very sophisticated, kind of balanced, disciplined fashion. And so actually, if you look at a practical matter at the kind of life he advocated, you would think he was, as I said earlier, living the life of a monk. He did not believe you should have any sex. Way too much downside on that one. He really felt that you should eat very, very modestly, sparingly, I would say. You know, that it was this almost tightrope. and I'm not going to take time to go through it, but the rules that he laid out for the pursuit of pleasure really makes you wonder, is there any pleasure left? But he did advocate the pursuit of the kinds of pleasures that don't bring much pain. Reading, reflecting, friendships. You know, actually, when you finally look at what he advocates, it's not bad. He was smart enough to figure out that the truly pleasurable life is going to involve more the pleasures of the soul than the pleasures of the body. And so I'm here not necessarily to bury Epicurus, but to rehabilitate him at least a little bit, you know, in your imaginations of him. All right, enough of him. Yes, please.
How did you get from the true Epicurus to what we have of him?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, just over time, probably the popular attitude took over. And that's why it's a little surprising, because we think of Epicureanism as a little bit more of the hedonistic approach. And I can't tell you, Ben, for sure when that metamorphosis took place. I think it's just kind of a gradual thing, you know, that can happen over time. Anything else on Epicurus? This is not really very deep stuff, but this is one kind of philosophical current to nail down. More profound was the next one, the Stoics. And so we'll take a little bit more of a look at the Stoics. The Stoics are associated with a guy by the name of Zeno. Not the Zeno who represented Parmenides of Zeno's paradoxes, but this man is named Zeno of Citium. That was the city from which he came. Z-E-N-O, and Citium is C-I-T-I-U-M, which I believe is a little city on one of the Greek islands. His years are 333 to 264, so he is a contemporary and a critic of Epicurus.
What was the second date?
264. Zeno, I would characterize as a utopian anarchist. Okay. He has his roots more deeply in the Cynics, going back here. He likes Diogenes. But again, what you have is kind of a great step forward. Diogenes was pretty crass in the way he advocated his philosophy, as you recall. Zeno is a little bit more genteel, but a lot of the same ideas are there. He founded his school in Athens in 308. So these two come to Athens about the same time, establish their schools about the same time. Epicurus starts the school called the Garden. The school of Zeno simply came to be called the Stoa. Anybody know what the word Stoa means, Greek word Stoa? The purists in the room.
I think it's
close. Stoa means porch. Porch. I remember when I was with the seniors 2 or 3 years ago, and we were standing on Mars Hill. Let's see, who was there? You were there? And I don't know if you remember, but I pointed to a little, maybe 200 or 300 yards away, or maybe a little more, is a pretty big building that's got a long kind of, elevated porch, I guess you'd say, with columns. And it was from that place that Zeno taught. And so he would stand up on this kind of very nice, very typically Greek sort of stage and address his followers. And it was just became popularly referred to as the porch, the Stoa. And thus the name Stoic was connected to that porch. So that's why they are called Stoics. So if I ask you, Mr. Dowers Jr., what comes to your mind with the word Stoic? What do you think of? What image does that conjure up?
Someone with a straight face.
Straight face. Very good. What else? If you're Stoic.
Seneca bleeding to death in a bathtub.
Seneca bleeding to death in a bathtub. Yes, indeed. That's what happened.
A warm bathtub.
I thought he poisoned himself. Did he stab himself? I think so, yeah. Yeah. Nero did that to him, yeah. What else, aside from Seneca and those kind of images? What else? What do you think of, Terry?
I think it's someone with deep convictions.
Deep convictions, okay. Gary. Right. Okay, good. Principled, you think? Okay. Connotations, what do you think of? Stoic?
Well, controlling their passions.
Right, controlling their passions. That's probably the one of the main ideas that we think of. Someone
Spock.
That's Spock! The ultimate Stoic is the Vulcan. That's right. You know. yeah, that's right. So Stoicism went through a kind of lengthy metamorphosis over time. So there's three stages of it. And these are called old, middle, and late Stoicism. Just as simple as that. Old Stoicism is associated with Zeno himself. We don't have much of his writings. We more or less know about him from others that wrote about him. But there are three fundamental principles that are associated with Zeno. So let me give these to you. The first is, again, a kind of modified materialism. I'm going to put that a little bit in quotes because it's not quite the raw materialism you'd find in Democritus or others, but it is fundamentally materialistic. Secondly, it is pantheistic. That's not spelled right. And thirdly, it is fatalistic. His materialism was, I want to guard against making it the same kind of materialism you'd find with some others. I would call it more a kind of back-to-nature-ism. He's sort of like the original hippie, but not. Okay, that's where the similarity ends right there, actually. So, but very, very keen on doing things according to nature. That there is a natural way to live. So Stoicism, at least originally, had this deep desire to see in nature the way life is and to conform to that standard. That we are, in a sense, a part of nature. There's no great difference between me and a pine tree or me and some other creature on this planet. That there's a natural order and that as such I should find my rhythm in life according to that natural order, that I shouldn't try to, you know, step outside of it, but really find this kind of serenity that flows from being part of it. So, you know, every time you see a back to nature kind of movement in a culture, you're seeing a little bit of a Stoicism there. What he included in this, which makes it not quite pure materialism, was something which he called the logos spermaticos. And so we have another important movement in Greek history that makes heavy use of the word logos. You see, spermaticos, Greek word for seed, sperm. And so he calls this the seed, and the other association here was the idea of fire. So he has all of that going on. So he has this picture that we are, as we share in nature and as we kind of get into the rhythm of nature, are also more or less getting into the rhythm of a kind of logos principle that he believes pulls together all of reality. And so the logos spermaticos is a kind of seed fire, as he called it, at the heart of nature. And then he said we all have in us the logoi spermaticoi, meaning a little piece of that fire in each of us. Okay? He was the first one to say, we all have within us a spark of the divine.
So is that popular,
right? Yeah, right. Yeah.
The idea basically just that that's like an animating principle?
Yeah, yeah, really, something like that. Yeah. And you can see the pantheistic aspects of that, that in a sense God is in everything. God is not a being to be worshipped or in any sense distant from reality, but is somehow in it. And I need to somehow find my meaning in this deep connection to the Logos Spermaticos, the seed fire, because I have some of it in me. And if I look within myself, I'll find that deep connection to nature, you know. It is a little bit, yeah, yeah. And the other piece of it is fatalism. Fatalism means what? What is that? What's a fatalist? Mr. Fugit, what is a fatalist? Do you know that word, fatalism?
It just ends.
Okay, that's could be part of it. Calvinists are often accused of being fatalists. Why would that be?
And the fates will have their way.
The fates have their way. You have no control. You know, no real freedom. Only in this sense, usually it means freedom over the external world. If I'm going to be in a car wreck this afternoon, you know, nothing I can do about that. There's no control I have over the forces of nature. Nature is this part, this thing of which I am a part, like a cog on a wheel. And there's really nothing I can do to break free from it. I am just part of it. You know, I'm just one more little piece of this great cosmic machine that's rumbling along. And I have nothing I can do to control that external world. The only thing I can control is my inner disposition toward it. You see, I can govern my emotions. So if I'm going to be hit this afternoon by a Mack truck, so be it. But rather than letting myself get upset about it, because I can't change it, I might as well not bother being distraught. I just accept it with a kind of what they called atarachia, an imperturbability, just a quiet serenity. Que sera, sera. This is the way it is, you see. And that's where we get that notion of being stoic, right? Stiff upper lip, just, you know. The Romans loved stoicism. And I would say that probably there's been no culture in the history of the world that embraced the Stoic ideal more than the Romans. And you think of the great Roman thinkers, you know, the Julius Caesar and other. You almost think of that kind of Roman, principled, you know, just not emotional, dignified, a kind of nobility about it, but a sort of, What's the word I'm after? Kind of resignation to, you know, this is the way it is. And so on. So anyway, that's the original contribution of Zeno. And it did get traction. And Stoicism goes through a middle period. We know virtually nothing about it, except we know it was there. The writings of that period are basically lost. And so I can't say anything to you about it, because it's just sort of the sandwich period. But then we get to this later period, which is called Roman Stoicism. And they really build on Zeno. So you've got the early Stoic ideal in Zeno, and then the later one adds to it. So we're going to call this late paren Roman Stoicism. This would come down to about the first century AD. So this is really dominating at the time of Christ. This would presumably be the form of Stoicism that Paul encountered when he came to the city of Athens and engages with, as you recall, the Stoics and the Epicureans. And they took him to Mars Hill. And he gave them a little Bible study. You know, remember that? All right. Later Stoicism has several principles, so again, I'm just going to, for the sake of clarity, just give these to you, and you'll find there's some similarity, but it's adjusted. It becomes somewhat more subtle as we go. The first principle of late Stoicism was a heavy accent on clear judgment. Stoicism was viewed as the philosophy which would help people exercise good, balanced, thoughtful, judicious reason, even in the face of threatening or chaotic circumstances. This is the person who, even though there's, you know, things coming at you and life seems to be out of control, maintains that kind of calm, so that you can continue to be clear in your judgments, your decisions, your strategies. And the Romans, of course, liked that idea very much. That was at the core of their thought. Second, discipline. Action over passion. You know. The Stoics are sometimes caricatured as either disparaging emotion or trying to repress emotion or otherwise ignore it. That's really not the Stoic idea. They were perfectly prepared to grant that emotion is a part of life. So a true Stoic was not just repressing every feeling, trying to turn himself into a robot or something, anything like that. They really did acknowledge that there is feeling, but what they tried to do was make that feeling have as little or hopefully no effect whatsoever on the decisions you're making. They didn't want feeling to influence your plans, your actions. The feelings are going to be there. But when it comes to what I decide I'm going to do, I need to take those feelings, set them aside, and exercise good judgment. They continued this idea of logos, and that became a major part of their thought. And what they meant by that was something like what Zeno meant. The logos represented a kind of principle of rationality in nature with which I can have some kind of harmonious connection. So this isn't that interesting. You see, the word logos was really getting a whole lot of attention in the first century. Heraclitus used it. Aristotle used it in a limited sense, not as much as others. But the Stoics had used it. A lot of the mystery religions used it. Philo, as we're going to see in a minute, used it. So when John the Apostle comes along in John 1:1 and says, "In the beginning was the Logos," he's saying a word that just kind of explodes in the Greek psyche there, because they're all about Logos in many different strands of their thought. And so for John to choose that word, he had to know what he was doing at that point. This was not an accident, that he would take a word that was so rich in its traditional sense. Then it became a big problem, and later, as we're going to see in the next, two or three weeks, it became a big problem. How much freight does the church want to put on that word? Because you put too much freight on that word, and we start looking as a religion like another version of Greek philosophy. The so-called Logos Christology was, at least in some ways, in some people's minds, a great capitulation to the Greeks. And so you have in the more Jewish quarters what were called the allagoi. They all objected to the use of the word logos. They didn't want that, This was one of the big first big debates in church history over the nature of Christ, was how we view the word logos. And part of the reason was because, so many Greek thinkers were using it, including the Stoics here. So it was a kind of a word that was in the air at the time. The next one was virtue. The Stoics were all about living a virtuous life. And in that connection, they advocated the so-called four cardinal virtues. which every classically educated person should know. The four cardinal virtues. Who knows them? Somebody in here must know them. Do you know them, Mr. Ingard? The four cardinal virtues. These have been generally recognized in the history of philosophy as the virtues that could be discovered simply by reflecting on life, on nature. You know, the four cardinal virtues. You've all heard them, I'm sure.
Temperance
is one of them. Very good. Temperance. What else? Another virtue? Be brave.
Patience?
You didn't take my bait. Be brave.
Courage.
Let's see. What did you say? You said patience. That doesn't make the list. Okay, you got temperance. You got courage. You have, no. Actually, charity is considered one of the divine virtues. The Christian faith took the four cardinal virtues and added the three, in other words, maybe the four natural virtues, and added the three supernatural virtues, which were 1 Corinthians 13, faith, hope, and love. And that's where charity comes in, you see. So, faith, hope, and charity. All right, here they are, wisdom and justice. Not necessarily in this order. So the Stoics were very concerned that we live lives that give, kind of a central place to virtue, and this is what they meant by virtue. They placed a heavy emphasis on education. They believed that evil, criminal behavior, flows from ignorance. If you just educate people, you will eradicate this world of crime. History has taught us that if you educate people, you get very, very well-educated crooks. that's a different discussion. But anyway, they placed a heavy emphasis on education. They said ignorance produces crime, evil. Finally, they were cosmopolitan. That's part of the reason that in the Greek world, isn't it interesting? The Roman world, the Romans are really the first ones who are ready to let anybody into the club. You know, the Greeks always had this kind of superiority attitude. Yeah, you go through the history of the great cultures of the world, and they always thought we are the greatest, you know. In some ethnic sense or some sort of provincial sense, we are the greatest. And the Romans really said, hey, we're going to conquer you, and then you can become citizens. Isn't that cool? You see? I mean, it was like anybody's welcome, and you could buy citizenship in Rome. You could join right in. You know that. That's one of the strange things about the Roman outlook. And it seemed to have been touched by this kind of Stoic attitude of a sort of cosmopolitan view of life, that we're not going to necessarily insist that one particular ethnicity is any better than any other, although the Romans still did believe that they were the best. Deep inside, Julius Caesar really did think that to be Roman was better than anything else. But officially, they did have this more open door policy. The three most famous Roman Stoics, these are names you want to at least make a mental note of, are first of all, Mr. Ingard,
Seneca.
Then there's two others. Anybody know the other two? This would be the first one. One of the most famous Roman Stoics of the first century. The next one is less known, but quite important, Epictetus. He writes, did I spell it right? Let me check. Yeah. Yes, it's right. No, I was afraid I made a mistake there. Yeah, it should be E. Epictete. T-U-S. Got it. Oh, Ms. Muse. How desperately I need fifth grade again. But my psyche was ruined when I was shown the writing of Marilyn Jackson. I've told you that story. Haven't I told you that?
No.
We had to do the little penmanship exercise, you know? Okay, everybody, boys and girls. You do that? Do we do that? We had to do that. And mine looked horrible. And then the teacher takes the penmanship product of Marilyn Jackson, who is, I mean, up there with Picasso, you know, or something. She says, "Now look, Brucie, look how Marilyn did it." It was the end. I've never been the same. You know, that's right. Marilyn Jackson did it to me. So, since then, I just despaired. That was in the second grade. Second grade. My whole career as having decent handwriting was destroyed. Seneca's first, Epictetus is second. Third one was a famous Roman, Caesar.
Marcus Aurelius.
Marcus Aurelius. Aurelius. A-U-R-E-L-I-U-S. Aurelius. And their writing is really fun. So if you ever, in fact, in the great books, you don't have that. Oh, you do. There's a volume in there that has quite a bit of Marcus Aurelius, and it's worth reading. It's a lot of fun. All right. So that's Stoics. That's Epicureans. I want to throw one more in, and that would be Philo. Yes. Questions. Go ahead.
This is probably a totally random question, but do you know if in a deck of cards, the suits, if they were chosen by the virtues?
I don't know. I don't. Have you heard that? That'd be great trivia.
There was a game that I used to play that spades was wisdom.
Oh.
Hearts was valiant. Hearts was temperance.
Yeah.
Clubs was courage, and diamonds were justice.
It's great.
And whenever you
never heard that.
Cards, you had a like with if there was an ace. If you didn't say a certain phrase, like "all hail the ace of wisdom."
Huh?
You got penalized in putting cards.
Sure, these weren't tarot cards.
That's right. I would like to know if that's the case. That's very interesting. You can ignore Mr. Fugit, of course. You know, he's all right. The last one that we want to talk about, this guy also figures into Hellenistic philosophy. The reason we're so interested in him, Philo, is because he clearly had some impact on the New Testament. Never mentioned in the New Testament, but it's almost beyond question that he helped to shape some of what we find in the New Testament. He is a Hellenistic philosopher. We probably wouldn't care a bit about him. He's not like one of the greatest thinkers in history, but he is strategically placed in history in the period of time from about 10 to 50. Actually, this should be 10 BC to about 50 AD. He's a Jewish philosopher. Does his work in the city of Alexandria. And he wants to bridge Jewish thought on the one hand with Greek philosophy on the other. He is a great, in his mind, synthesizer. Now, when you read him, you think, you know, you're Jewish in name, but you're Greek in thought. I mean, so the synthesis really fails because he's much more, he really loves Plato and loves the Greeks. And kind of sells the farm when it comes to his fidelity to the Old Testament. But nevertheless, that's what he wants to do. And the way he achieves this is he takes the Old Testament scriptures and he takes an interpretive approach that allegorizes it. So he goes through the Old Testament, and every time he finds a story in the Old Testament that you thought you knew what it meant, he finds all new meanings there. And again, very consistently, all of those meanings are always Plato's philosophy or Aristotle's insight, and he finds that by allegorizing. So when the children of Israel, you know, leave Egypt and head for the promised land, they're leaving the world of the receptacle and going to the world of the ideal. That would be the kind of thing he does, allegorizing freely the stories, you know. And there's no particular rule by which he does this. He just does it with reckless abandon. He just takes stories and just turns them into wonderful tributes to Plato's philosophy and others. So he's pretty important, not so much because he's brilliant, but because he does get quite a following in his time. He has, again, three major themes. Sorry to keep giving you these themes, but it's the easiest way to try to wade through this. The first of which, not surprisingly, Philo makes a huge amount out of Logos. His approach, however, to Logos is something like this. It's a little bit like what we saw with Aristotle. He sees God as this kind of central being, and then he says God emanates creation. And the word emanate means to kind of shine being. I don't know how else to put this. You think of the sun shining, radiating. God emanates. So if you can imagine God kind of, these are layers, like concentric circles, you know, that surround God, and he's producing, by this sort of emanation, as it was called, the rest of creation. So that's Philo. That's not very Jewish. That is quite Greek, you know. And then he says the highest level of emanation is called the Logos, which he also says is the highest angel. And then he says there are lower angels, archangels, so on, run-of-the-mill angels. Down here is humanity, so on down till you get plants and stuff, you know. We looked a little bit at this, didn't we? Did we do that in here? We didn't. This is new? Okay. See, I'm teaching a lot of this stuff to the seniors, and then I start getting confused. Where did I say what? So, anyway, does that make sense? So the highest being, just almost God, just barely beneath God in being, is the Logos. And then you keep working down. You've got man down here, plants, you know, rocks, so on. You get the picture. That's the cosmology that he adopted. So the point here, the first thing to get, is that has this very high view of Logos, in which the Logos is almost divine. In fact, it is divine. It's not equal to God, but it's just barely less than God, the Logos. Secondly, he also places a heavy emphasis on virtue, and his approach to virtue is almost identical to the Stoics. So he's borrowing from the Greeks fast and furious, and he takes this kind of approach. He works these virtues out in the most amazing ways. He's the story of the Garden of Eden, in which Adam is kind of this neutral soul, and along comes the temptress Eve, and you know, it's just amazingly fanciful stuff. It's fun to read, but just get the idea here. And then the final thing he introduces is what's called cyclical history. Oops. Cyclical meaning history just keeps going around and around, you know, like a great Ferris wheel, not really going anywhere, so that salvation is escape from history. History is not heading toward a salvation, but rather we escape from history to find salvation in a very Platonic sense. Philo gave us what was commonly called and has been called a kind of Jewish Gnosticism. And he had quite a following throughout the Jewish world. He never got the respect he wanted from the Greek world. What he wanted to do was be a missionary to the Greeks. and say to all of the Greeks out there, oh, do you see? Moses already knew it all. It was already there in Moses. All the great insights of your Greek philosophers was right there in the Old Testament. Here, let me prove it to you. Then he reads the Old Testament, allegorizes everything, and says, so, do you see? The Old Testament teaches the same thing Plato said. Do you see? That's how he did. Well, the Greek world was kind of ho-hum about it. The Jewish world got very excited. And so you have a whole kind of subculture of the Jewish world in the first century, which was really taken with Greek thought, very influenced by Hellenism, and they found in Philo a sort of intellectual basis upon which they could embrace a great deal of what was attractive in Greek thought. And it created a hybrid in the first century called Jewish Gnosticism. And it's almost certain that at least some of the New Testament was written in response to Jewish Gnosticism, largely as it came from Philo. So let me ask you, with that much of a hint, what book or books can you think of in the New Testament that likely were written to respond, really as a critique, to Jewish Gnosticism, largely from Philo? What? Neither one. First John, maybe. First John, although actually what you have in First John doesn't have enough in common with Philo to quite make the list, but that's a pretty good thing. It is certainly responding to a kind of Gnosticism of the first century, but the Jewish piece is not quite as present there as it is in the book of?
Corinthians?
No? No? Colossians. If you read Colossians, you'll find it's a little odd, some of the things Paul talks about. It seems a little off the wall, because he talks about, you know, angel worship. But he also talks about circumcision. He talks about Sabbath observances, but also says, don't let people deceive you by vain philosophy. You know, it's kind of a strange mix of references in the book of Colossians. And if you read it against the backdrop of the time, it's just, you know, virtually certain at this point that there were people in the city of Colossae and in Asia Minor generally that had been deeply touched by Philo and actually seemed to have thought that the Christian faith was simply another expression of that kind of Jewish Gnosticism. And Paul doesn't want to tolerate that, and so he writes Colossians, which is a pretty... And if you read it with that in mind, you'll find virtually everything he says in there is addressing that point. Christ is not to be understood as something inferior. In him is all the fullness of Godhead, of the Godhead bodily, you see. In other words, he's trying to correct a view that would sort of diminish the status of Christ and make him something less than, you know, what we would affirm Christ is, God himself. And the criticisms of don't taste, don't touch, don't handle, that was the kind of pursuit of virtue you'd find in Philo, where you have this sort of regimented, almost ascetic kind of approach. So anyway, that's one. There's another book that even has more, clearly, a desire to respond to and critique Philo.
Hebrews.
Excellent. That is it. You read Hebrews. What's the first chapter of Hebrews warning against, basically? What's it all about? The first chapter of Hebrews. It's all about angel worship, you know? It goes through and deals with Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a huge theme in Philo. He wanted to make Melchizedek kind of one of these layers, and he wanted to make him a kind of allegorical character to make his case. And virtually everything the writer to the Hebrews talks about is a theme picked up in from Philo and critiquing it, you know. Yeah.
So the people that assume that Apollos wrote,
yeah,
Hebrews,
right.
Apollos was an Alexandrian Jew, right?
You know, I'm telling you, you just let the big cat right out of the bag. I was going to set this up. I was going to make it my last big culminating point. I was going to say this. Now, there's been a big debate in church about who wrote the book of Hebrews, and I'm going to give you some hints and see if you can figure it out. So, you know, so here are my hints. The guy that wrote the book of Hebrews was Jewish? It was Paul. Yeah. He was influenced by Paul. He had to be from Alexandria because he uses more Alexandrian Philo vocabulary than anybody else by far in the New Testament. You know, I mean, it cannot be an accident. People go through and read Hebrews who are familiar with Philo. They just find Philo's vocabulary all over the place. It's likely the author had actually been a student of Philo. But he's not writing Hebrews to agree with Philo, but to give this kind of pretty significant critique. He's well-educated, he's a rhetorician, and the only guy in the New Testament who could fit all that would be, of course, Mr. Young. It's got to be Apollos, right? So if you've ever wondered who wrote the book of Hebrews, you've now heard it. Resolving, once and for all, that great standing controversy about who was the author. Actually, I got that whole thing from Ron Nash. Anybody who knows his name, I did not come up with that on my own. That was his little contribution. So if I'm wrong, I'm just going to blame him. But I found it pretty persuasive. So anyway. All right. I'm done. Comments, questions, thoughts. This is not the most exciting piece of our journey through philosophy. But, you know, it's 300 years of pretty important era of, as I say, kind of a philosophical malaise. So there, we've done it.